And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, and certainly in June of 1950, America counted as the greatest nation on God's green earth. The rest of the world had been devastated by World War II. The United States stood strong and confident, leading planet Earth. And yet, we found ourselves involved in a brutal, difficult, surprisingly impossible at the early stages, war against the People's Republic of Korea, the dictatorship of North Korea. How did that happen? And what about another mismatched conflict, a conflict involving Captain Harry of Battery D, otherwise known as former artillery Captain Harry Truman in World War I, versus a general of the Army, Douglas MacArthur, five-star general, commanding general of the U.S. Army Forces Far East, U.S. Commander-in-Chief Far East Command, Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers in Japan, and Commander-in-Chief of the United Nations Command. The way these two confrontations turned out helped to determine the future not only of constitutional government, but of the world order that emerged after one of America's most misunderstood and yet most consequential conflicts, the conflict in Korea, remembering the forgotten war. And it's impossible to understand the course of that forgotten war without also remembering the amazing personality of General Douglas MacArthur. No commander in American history more celebrated, more decorated, more legendary than General MacArthur. He was the son of another Army Chief of Staff and Congressional Medal of Honor winner, as he was. He became the youngest major general in the Army. He became Army Chief of Staff, Superintendent of West Point, and, of course, a great hero of World War II. His proclamation when he evacuated the Philippines the first time, "I shall return." Of course, it was "I shall return," not "we shall return." But that was General MacArthur. Harry Truman, who had never met MacArthur before the Korean conflict began, and didn't meet him until that conflict was in one particularly decisive stage, had a very, very strong diagnosis of what was wrong with General MacArthur and his limitations. Recalling this years later with Merle Miller in the book Plain Speaking, he said, well, there's a story. On his 90th birthday, I think it was, somebody asked Justice Holmes, Oliver Wendell Holmes, how he figured he'd done all he had done, been a Supreme Court justice and a soldier in the Civil War and all of that. The fellow that asked him, a newspaper fellow, says, "What's the secret of your success, Justice Holmes?" And old Holmes up and says, "Young man, the secret of my success is that at a very early age, I discovered that I'm not God." Well, I told you, MacArthur never did find that out. And that was his trouble. MacArthur had a history of difficult relationships with his commanders in chief. He was Army Chief of Staff before World War II, and he continued as Chief of Staff after Franklin D. Roosevelt defeated Herbert Hoover. And he was very, very much opposed to some of the trends in the Roosevelt administration, where they wanted to cut back and cut back and cut back on the Army. They, in fact, wanted to cut 51% of the Army's budget. MacArthur, to his credit, was a very powerful voice for a strong military, and he criticized pacifism and isolationism. Good for him. But the most decisive exchange between Roosevelt and MacArthur occurred when the administration had on the table this idea of cutting the Army budget 51%. So Chief of Staff MacArthur came to the White House, and he then lectured the President of the United States, saying, "When we lose the next war, and an American boy lying in the mud with an enemy bayonet through his belly and an enemy foot on his dying throat spits out his last curse, I want the name not to be MacArthur, but Roosevelt." FDR blew up, as you can imagine. It's a fairly awful thing to say. And Roosevelt said, "You must not talk that way to the President of the United States." So MacArthur stood up, said, "You want me to resign? I will resign. Roosevelt said, you can't resign. Then MacArthur just stormed out of the White House and went to the front steps and vomited. It's unclear whether this eloquent reaction resulted from his nerves at having that kind of confrontation with the most powerful man in the world, or whether he was actually expressing his opinion of FDR. Either way, that's the kind of guy that Douglas MacArthur was. He did not play well with others. He didn't fully accept the idea that as the chief of staff of the army, or later as a major commander in the army, that the president of the United States really was his boss. And yet, he had done an unbelievably brilliant job running the occupation of Japan, helping to put Japan on the road to stability and ultimately to prosperity and to democracy. And his leadership abilities were unquestioned. In fact, so much so that he was a serious candidate for president in 1948. Oh, yeah, he was running against Harry Truman. Now, he didn't actually come back to the United States to campaign, which is one of the things that's very strange. He had been out of the country since 1937, serving his country in the Far East as a military commander. However, he was considered one of the favorites for the GOP nomination. His name was up in the Wisconsin primary, and he actually won 8 delegates in Wisconsin, but that wasn't nearly enough. The nomination went to Tom Dewey, and Truman won. Truman, however, was a fairly big guy, and he knew that MacArthur, of course, had the confidence of his fellow officers, and that MacArthur, if he allowed himself to be supervised by the chief of staff back in Washington, would be the most effective commander we could possibly find. The two men determined to work together. And in the early days of the war, that was desperately necessary. Why? Because the war went just amazingly badly. The early stages of the war, the U.S. forces could not get to Korea in time. One of the things that Truman knew that he had to do was to try to protect the Chinese nationalists in Formosa, in Taiwan, because there was a fear that at the same time that the North Koreans were invading South Korea, that if the United States put all of its chips on to defending South Korea, that the Chinese communists who had recently taken over might actually take advantage of the situation to make a move on Formosa. So Truman is trying very hard to send enough forces to prevent a complete American disaster. Eric F. Goldman, the Princeton professor who wrote a fine book, The Crucial Decade and After America, 1945 to 1960, writes that Americans were reading daily the evidence that even the GI was no longer his cocky, wisecracking self, ever retreating, outmanned, outtanked, outsupplied, outflanked, and outyelled, fighting over sawtooth ridges, wreck-littered roads, and paddies fertilized by human excrement. Most of the American soldiers were glum, bitter, confused. The average GI had not the slightest idea why he was battling on these far-off hills. "I'll fight for my country," Corporal Stephen Zegg of Chicago put it, "but I'll be damned if I see why I'm fighting to save this hellhole." He may not have actually said hell. The situation became desperate. The United States lost 29 bombers that were shot down by the Koreans. We lost 18 fighter planes. It was even our Air Force could not seem to avail. But MacArthur slowly, steadily moved enough troops to try to slow the northern advance. At one point, the North Koreans had pushed the Americans into a tiny corner in the Pusan perimeter, and leaving only 10% of the entire Korean peninsula that was held by the Americans and the South Koreans. The North had taken over Seoul and everything else. They were facing a risk of having to be evacuated, as in Dunkirk, the Americans, and the South Koreans being pushed into the sea. Meanwhile, MacArthur planned a counterattack. And the counterattack involved one of the most daring and famous and justly celebrated military maneuvers in the annals of American warfare. It involved taking this tiny little perimeter, which the Americans came to defend, strong reinforcements coming in, anti-tank weapons coming in, more tanks coming in, Air Force reinforcements, the Air Force slowing down and softening up the North Koreans. With all of that happening, MacArthur wanted to use the Navy to go far around the North Korean lines and come up behind them and destroy the enemy.
Sports Foundation. Learn more at nssf.org.
And you can save 15% or even more on car insurance with GEICO. Just call 1-800-947-AUTO or go to geico.com. Just 80 days after the North Koreans crashed into South Korea, sweeping all before them, occupying the capital of Seoul, driving the South Koreans and their American allies. The Americans also were supported by Australian and New Zealand and British and some French and a good number of Turkish troops as well. The UN command under Douglas MacArthur had been pushed to a tiny little corner at the very southeastern corner of the Korean Peninsula. And what MacArthur did with the Incheon landing was so masterful, so brilliant. It's still studied in military textbooks. He took a major part of his force and put it on ships and moved it with an amphibious landing all the way around and behind the enemy lines, landed successfully, and in less than 80 days after the North Koreans had invaded, the tide of war had turned totally. The Incheon landing was a spectacular success. Seoul was captured 10 days later. Basically, the Americans and the South Koreans came all the way up to the 38th parallel, which had been the original dividing line between North and South Korea. And they took 130,000 North Koreans prisoner, a huge portion, a close to half of the army that the North Koreans were using at the time. Harry Truman wrote to General MacArthur in a telegram, "Few operations in military history can match either the delaying action where you traded space for time in which to build up your forces, or the brilliant maneuver which has now resulted in the liberation of Seoul. Well and nobly done." And it was. MacArthur, who was already a national hero, became even more of a hero. And unfortunately, he ignored the rest of Truman's telegram, which indicated, "We have to fight a while longer in order to convince the North Koreans that they are vanquished and that further aggression doesn't pay." But the intention, at least originally, of the entire UN resolution was basically to drive the North Koreans out of South Korea, to push them back north of the 38th parallel, and to reestablish the situation as it existed before they had invaded in June. This is all taking place in September and October of 1950. And to discuss what should happen next, Truman wanted to meet with MacArthur. And his original idea was that MacArthur should fly back to Washington because it would be very instructive about who really was in charge. It had to be the civilian leadership. That's the way the Constitution is set up. It had to be the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Army brass. But Truman's political advisor said, "Wait a minute. MacArthur hasn't been in the country in more than 13 years. If he comes back after having won this big victory at Incheon, there will be this national sensation. It's going to undermine your presidency. He's going to look very, very big, Mr. President, and you're going to look very, very small." So they suggested that they should meet halfway. Now, halfway might have been San Francisco or close to it, but instead they decided to meet at Wake Island, which was a tiny American outpost in the South Pacific, and it was not at all halfway. It was 4,700 miles from San Francisco, so much further than that from Washington, D.C., while the general flew only 1,900 miles from Tokyo. And by the way, one of the characteristics of MacArthur's command was he was very, very well established in Tokyo. He basically was the de facto ruler of Japan. And he conducted most of the Korean War from Tokyo. He did not move himself or his headquarters to Korea. He was not on the front lines with most of his men. But when Truman flew all this way and flew all the way from San Francisco to Wake Island to meet with MacArthur. They went through this hilarious little dance about whose plane would land first, because MacArthur wanted the president to land first so that he could dramatically come down out of the sky. And it was like the bigger guy is the second one to arrive. So sure enough, MacArthur's plane was taking its own sweet time. Truman had landed first, but he refused to get out of the plane. And so they played this game. And when MacArthur's plane finally landed, Truman still refused to get out of the plane until MacArthur was coming down the ramp from his airplane. And then Truman came down the ramp from his airplane. And they seemed to get along fine. The fears of some kind of contest. The big concern for Harry Truman and for the whole civilian leadership of the United States was that it seemed that the war had just about been won. MacArthur didn't think that. The question was, what should they do? Should they push far beyond the 38th parallel? Now, on October 3rd, before the meeting at Wake Island, the Chinese Communist foreign minister told the Indian ambassador in Beijing, and the Indians, of course, were officially neutral at this time, so they're considered a big, good way to get messages between the Americans and the Chinese. The Communist foreign minister told the Indian ambassador in Beijing that the Red Chinese would intervene massively in the war if MacArthur and the UN forces crossed the 38th parallel. But that warning was largely discounted. When Truman met with MacArthur, MacArthur said it was not possible that the Chinese would come into the war. He was asked, what about the possibility of Chinese or Soviet intervention? He said, very little possibility. We are no longer fearful of their intervention. If the Chinese tried to get down to Pyongyang, there would be the greatest slaughter. He was very confident. He added he believed that all enemy resistance would be crushed by Thanksgiving. This was in October. And that he, in fact, dubbed his current military operations Operation Home by Christmas. The result of MacArthur's confidence was that the UN General Assembly approved a resolution saying, recalling that the essential objective was the establishment of a unified, independent, and democratic Korea, the UN General Assembly authorized UN forces to move ahead into North Korea. MacArthur did that, meeting very little opposition. He had won a smashing victory. And Operation Home by Christmas continued right up to the Yalu River. The Yalu River was the border of China. Now, China, remember, had just recently, only a little bit more than a year before, become a communist country. And MacArthur still had hopes of reversing that. But things did not at all turn out the way the general had hoped. And no, the troops were not home by Christmas. The saga of the Korean conflict continued. MacArthur launched his final offensive of the war, of part of his Operation Home for Christmas, on November 24th, 1950. He had completely changed the complexion of the war. The American forces were sweeping all before them. MacArthur was supremely confident that there would be no Chinese intervention, and he gathered reporters around him in his base in Tokyo and said, "The war very definitely is coming to an end shortly." That was November 24th. Unfortunately, the Chinese had a different plan in mind. November 26th, 2 days later, a Chinese Communist army drove a flying wedge right through the central sector of the American lines. The Americans had spread themselves very thin to occupy all of North Korea. And suddenly, the UN forces had to retreat in total disarray all the way down the peninsula. Ultimately, the Chinese pumped in hundreds of thousands of troops into the war, and it was an unspeakable American disaster. Even MacArthur had to admit, we face an entirely new war. Truman made the announcement to his staff at a very dramatic White House meeting. He stood up at the middle of his desk and with shuffled papers there, and then very quietly said to the assembled staff, General Bradley called me at 6:15 this morning. He told me that a terrible message had come from General MacArthur. The Chinese have come in with both feet. The results for American GIs were almost unbelievably painful. They had to take their equipment and their often wounded comrades down rocky ridges, winding roads, forested bluffs, with Chinese often pouring over them and shooting at them. Sub-zero cold, violent snowstorms, and sudden wild gorges 2,000 feet deep were as much of a menace as the communist, writes Eric Goldman. A large part of the fighting was during the night and at close quarters with pistols, grenades, and submachine guns. 2,651 wounded were flown out in only 4 days. On one occasion, 117 bodies were buried in a single grave, and a bulldozer used to push a covering over them. There was no time for anything else when a grave had to be blasted out of ground that was frozen down to 18 inches. Major General Oliver P. Smith, 33 years in the Marine Corps, he was now the proud commander of the 1st Marine Division, sent out these defiant words, "Retreat? Hell! We're only attacking in another direction." But they were retreating, and soon the UN forces had abandoned Seoul. The communists had taken Seoul once again, and MacArthur was desperate. On December 9, 1950, MacArthur requested authorization to use atom bombs. On December 24th, he submitted a list of 26 targets. He also requested 4 bombs to drop on invading forces and 4 more for critical concentrations of enemy air power. Now, atom bombs had been used 5 years before, of course, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, winning World War II. But MacArthur had an even bolder idea. He wanted to drop 30 to 50 atom bombs all across the neck of Manchuria to produce, quote, a belt of radioactive cobalt that would win the war in 10 days and prevent the Chinese from trying to send more men down that way. But that was just the short-term effect. He also hoped that the belt of radioactive cobalt would spread from the Sea of Japan to the Yellow Sea, so that for at least 60 years, there could have been no land invasion of Korea from the north. General Bradley, the Army Chief of Staff and the Joint Chiefs of Staff back home and the President thought this was a poor idea. In fact, it could have been a world-ending idea. Meanwhile, MacArthur began issuing statements from Tokyo blaming everyone else for the disaster that the American troops were facing. What happened next made history. We'll be right back. Minds.com. Search InstaFit for details. Even at the best of times, with American troops sweeping all before them, the relationships between General MacArthur and his bosses, including the President of the United States back in Washington, were strained. But when things began to go horribly wrong in late November of 1950, those relations became intensely problematic. MacArthur began issuing a series of statements out of Tokyo, basically suggesting that the problems in Korea had nothing to do with the faulty intelligence. The intelligence was terrible. It had nothing to do with problematic tactics of MacArthur spreading the American lines too thin. It all had to do with Washington decisions to fight only a limited war and to forbid MacArthur from attacking the Chinese bases in Manchuria. MacArthur said this privileged sanctuary was an enormous handicap without precedent in military history. On December 6th, he got an order in no uncertain terms from Truman that all future statements had to be cleared with Washington. Well, this didn't last very long, because as the Americans, because of the courage of the troops and of some of the commanders in the field, including Matthew Ridgway, who had an interesting habit, he used to wear on his uniform, he would put two hand grenades on either side of his chest, which led to one of the more colorful nicknames in American military history. He was known very affectionately to his troops as Old Iron. And Ridgway was a fighting general, and he helped to stabilize the American line. Seoul was conquered again. The North Koreans swept into Seoul, but the American line stabilized, and things began to slow down. And Truman and his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, had the idea that with the battlefield solidifying and lines being drawn, this was a good time to try to work on some kind of a truce. Because after all, the whole purpose of American involvement initially had been to drive the North out of South Korea. The administration felt that the time was perfect to try to get a negotiated settlement. They could settle along the lines that would be close to the 38th parallel where the war had started. So on March 20th, 1951, Washington told MacArthur the U.S. and the U.N. felt that, quote, further diplomatic efforts toward settlement should be made before any advance with major forces north of the 38th parallel, because there was a possibility that MacArthur was going to try another advance north of the 38th parallel. They were planning these diplomatic moves, but before they could, MacArthur issued another public statement, emphatically not cleared with the administration, that said there is no substitute for victory, and demanding that the Chinese and the North Koreans totally surrender. This blew the entire diplomatic initiative to smithereens. Later, Truman wrote in his memoirs, "By this act, MacArthur left me no choice. I could no longer tolerate his insubordination." But he didn't move yet. He didn't move until MacArthur, remember, who had strong Republican ties and had been a candidate for president to run against Harry Truman, sent a letter to Congressman Joe Martin of Massachusetts. He was the Republican leader in the House. And Martin then read the letter from MacArthur on the floor. And the letter once again said there was no substitute for victory, that it was essential for the future of civilization that America win a total unconditional victory. That was too much, especially given the fact that he had sent the letter to the opposition party deliberately attempting to undermine the administration. So on April 11th, 1951, the White House press corps got the announcement, and they got it with difficulty, that the president was going to hold a press conference at 1 in the morning. Highly unusual. The reporters were bleary-eyed. They wondered what could possibly be that important that the president would call a press conference in the middle of the night. And they soon found out President Truman had relieved General Douglas MacArthur of all his commands: a Supreme Commander, Allied Powers, Commander-in-Chief, United Nations Command, Commander-in-Chief, Far East, and Commanding General, U.S. Army, Far East. The president felt that he could not preserve civilian control of the military and keep MacArthur in place. The response when this became known in the country was devastating and entirely negative. There were 78,000 telegrams and letters to the White House immediately. They ran 20-1 against Truman and pro-MacArthur. Time magazine wrote, "The most popular man in America has been fired by the most unpopular man in America. Very quickly, the Gallup poll measured Truman's approval rating at an all-time low at the time. And in fact, it's an all-time low except for Nixon during Watergate and Bush at the very nadir of his presidency. 26% approved of Truman. In the conflict with MacArthur, 69% of Americans said they agreed with General MacArthur. Arthur Schlesinger, the very great historian and one-time advisor to President Kennedy, said that the core of the Truman-MacArthur controversy had to do with a difference in perspective. MacArthur said, in war, there is no substitute for victory. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. The administration, he writes, on the other hand, saw the conflict as a limited war for limited objectives. If Manchuria was a privileged sanctuary, so were Okinawa and Japan. To use all the national power and transform a limited war into a general war against communist China would be, in the words of General Omar Bradley, to fight the wrong war at the wrong place at the wrong time and with the wrong enemy. That's what he said during the hearings that investigated MacArthur's firing. But meanwhile, MacArthur came home to a hero's welcome to challenge the president. What happened next stirred Americans profoundly. More coming on the story of the conflict in Korea.
To purchase this show, Conflict in Korea, Remembering the Forgotten War, go to medvidhistorystore.com.
From coast to coast, Harry Truman was burned in effigy. As a matter of fact, in Los Angeles, the city council adjourned in sorrowful contemplation of the political assassination of General MacArthur. They passed a resolution in that behalf. In many cities across the country, they flew flags at half-mast because MacArthur had been fired. MacArthur himself did not speak to reporters, obviously, but his aide-de-camp, Major General Courtney Whitney, did. General Whitney said, "I have just left him. He received the word of the president's dismissal from command magnificently. He never turned a hair. His soldierly qualities were never more pronounced. This has been his finest hour." No one at the time thought it was Truman's finest hour. In fact, the Republicans were talking impeachment. Senator Taft and other major Republican figures gathered in the office of the House GOP leader, Joseph Martin, the same one who's received the letter that provoked the firing. And Taft told reporters that they had agreed that MacArthur should come and address a joint session of Congress and that the whole foreign and military policy of the Truman administration should be investigated. In addition, Joe Martin told the press the question of impeachments was discussed. He emphasized the S on the word impeachments. They were going to go after not just President Truman, but Secretary of State Dean Acheson as well. The response when MacArthur came back to the United States, it was the first time in nearly 15 years, and he flew on his special Constellation plane all the way from Tokyo to San Francisco. 100,000 people gathered in front of San Francisco's City Hall and cheered themselves crazy when MacArthur said, "The only politics I have is contained in a single phrase known well to all of you, God bless America." The press at the time estimated 7 million people, the most ever, gathered in a ticker tape parade when General MacArthur came to New York. When he came to Washington, D.C., he had 300,000 people gathering in a parade to pay him tribute. But the dramatic moment came when he addressed the Congress of the United States. For people who don't understand this kind of emotion, looking at that televised speech, which was nationally televised, is illuminating. MacArthur was one of the greatest orators in American history. My late father, who hated General MacArthur's guts, was moved to tears, as were Americans everywhere. What happened after that speech to determine the course of the war? And what about the forgotten heroes of that war? That and more, the subject of this special program about the conflict in Korea and its impact on this greatest nation on God's green earth.